Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss the latest news from across Ukraine as Russia's grinding advance continues in the east. We delve deeper into the tank's arms race following the news that Ukraine has withdrawn the American Abrams from frontline service. And Francis Dernley interviews Serhii Kusan, the head of the Ukrainian Security and Cooperation Center.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Monday, the 29th of April, 2 years and 66 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor Francis Dernley, and Telegraph contributor and former tank commander Hamish de Bratton Gordon. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. Another busy weekend, as expected. Ukraine says it foiled 55 separate Russian attacks in the eastern Donetsk region alone, mainly clustered in the villages north of Avdiivka. They are seemingly trying to, if not consolidate, then push on for as much as they can, exploit what they can of this salient that's been developing there, although they've not got much further than that, than what we were reporting last week. They're obviously trying to exploit the success, as I say, but they're keen to try and get whatever they can before the weapons arrive from the US supplemental that was signed off recently. Ukraine's commander-in-chief, Oleksandr Syrsky, he admitted to a worsening situation on the front line and on Sunday said his troops had retreated to new defensive lines further to the west in some areas. He described the situation in the Pokrovsk and Kurkove sectors as the most difficult one now. That area is about 20 k's west of Donetsk city. It encompasses the area of the Russian salient, but that is under extreme pressure, and that's where any possible breakthrough would be most obvious. General Syrsky said Russia's using up to four brigades worth of personnel. So, I mean, depending on the role of the brigade and slightly different in the Ukrainian model to NATO models, but you could be looking at anything from the 10 to 25-ish thousand people, perhaps. He said, in general, the enemy has succeeded tactically in these directions, but has failed to achieve an operational advantage. He said Russian troops are attacking across the entire front line, and the situation is changing dynamically. He described the situation in the south as intense, and said Russian forces continue operations in the Kupiansk Liman settlements up in Kharkiv Oblast. Now, yesterday, he was speaking yesterday, he said Russia had made some tactical progress across the front, but Moscow had not yet achieved what he called an operational advantage. I think that's what we've been saying recently. I mean, they are moving forward in small gains, but nothing of any great stride at the moment. I'll speak a little bit later about the press conference on Friday, which included the US chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But at that, General Brown said Russia has made incremental gains, but at tremendous cost. So I think that's what we've been reporting for the last few weeks. So, yes, so they are going west, but the numbers of casualties are extreme. He also said, General Sursky, this is, said additional Ukrainian units were being deployed to replace those at the front that had sustained heavy losses. Now, elsewhere, Russian attacks on Ukraine have caused deaths and injuries across the whole country in the last 24 hours, although limited in number and mainly in the east. Also over the weekend, the Security Service of Ukraine, the SBU, allegedly launched drone strikes against two oil refineries and a military airfield in Russia's Krasnodar region. That was on Friday, Saturday. Drones hit key technological objects, apparently, at the Ilsky and Slavyansk oil refineries. They are both they're in the same area, about 100 k's due east of the Kerch Bridge, causing fires and evacuation of personnel, a source of the SBU speaking to the Kyiv Independent said. Now, the SBU and Ukraine's defence forces more broadly also hit the Kushchevskaya military air base. That's about 150 k's further north towards Rostov-on-Don and slightly inland from the Sea of Azov. They said dozens of military aircraft, radars and electronic warfare devices were stationed. Russia's MOD claimed that their forces had shot down 66 Ukrainian drones over the Krasnodar region and two more drones over occupied Crimea over the weekend. Outside the country, just a note, two Ukrainian service personnel on medical rehabilitation were stabbed in Germany, killed in Germany. Two Ukrainian men, they were stabbed in the Murnau am Staffelsee area. That's about 50 k's due south of Munich in Germany. They're on medical rehabilitation leave. This comes from the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry. A 57-year-old Russian national, or described by locals as a Russian-speaking person wearing a lot of Z symbology, has been arrested by German authorities there. And on today's, just a couple more for me, David, today's British MOD intelligence update, they say that according to the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, 604 civilians were killed or wounded in March, on average throughout March. They say that equates to a 20% increase over the previous months and are attributed to missile and aerial munition strikes throughout Ukraine, plus the increased bombardment at the front lines, as we've seen since Avdiivka fell, really, in mid-Feb, and the supplemental vote. Now, their report highlights what they say is increased coordinated strikes. So this is what British MOD say is increased coordinated strikes on Ukrainian critical infrastructure. And they say 57 children killed, double the previous month, and attributed directly to the use of aerial munitions, in particular the new glide bombs. So in total, the UN say there's been nearly 31,500 civilian casualties in Ukraine across Ukrainian-controlled and Russian-controlled territories since the start of the full-scale invasion, nearly 11,000 killed and over 20,000 wounded. And sticking with the British MOD assessment, you may remember earlier in April, they said Russian troops in Ukraine are mainly staffed with contract soldiers and reservists mobilised in late 2022, but accepted that the conscripts are often pressured to sign contracts. It used to be that conscripts would not serve in a war. That has been broken anyway, but there's also thought to be widespread pressure to get conscripts to sign contracts. Today, the Kyiv Independent, quoting the Ukrainian Military Intelligence Agency, the HUR, said over 18,000 Russian soldiers from Russia's southern military district have all allegedly deserted. Of this number, they say around 10,000 are mobilised conscripts and 2,000 contract soldiers. Around 12,000 are thought to belong to the 8th Combined Arms Army, a unit often deployed in eastern Ukraine. And low morale is put down as the main reason for this. Interesting addition, I think, because we often talk about casualty figures and we say casualty figures are killed, wounded, missing and taken prisoner. So I think that just this sort of figure here, and we've come to accept within a healthy margin of error, but not a ridiculous margin of error, the statistics that the Ukrainian authorities are putting out. So that would suggest, David, that there's quite a lot of dissatisfaction with a very high casualty level, particularly in the east at the moment. As I said, what General Brown is saying, the ground is coming at incremental gains, but at tremendous cost. And I'll take a pause there, David.
Thank you very much, Dom. We'll come back to you later, I'm sure. Francis, can I come to you first? I know there's quite a few different updates you want to talk about. Let's start with the international updates. Francis Sternley.
Thanks, David. If we fail to help Ukraine, what does it say about us? So asks Estonia's Prime Minister Kaja Kallas in an exclusive interview with The Telegraph, arguing that British and American defence pledges for Kyiv should inspire other countries to follow suit. Ms Kallas was speaking after London pledged that £500 million for Ukraine and its largest ever provision of vital supplies, including some 400 vehicles, 1,600 munitions and 4 million rounds of ammunition. That package came as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak also announced plans to boost British defence spending to 2% of GDP by 2030, something we discussed at length on the podcast last week. And, of course, after the US finally approved its long-delayed $60 billion aid package for Ukraine. So to quote Ms Kallas, the free world must demonstrate the will to defeat Russian aggression in Ukraine. This is the best and cheapest way to ensure all of our security. Russia's goals have not changed. It has always played on the card of one day our help diminishing and our unity crumbling. In this regard, every arms and ammunition package are highly welcome. It should also inspire others to deliver to Ukraine what it urgently needs. We should not forget that we have the resources and expertise. Our strength outweighs Russia's. She goes on. In NATO, 2% of GDP on defence is the agreed minimum, but not everyone has been doing this. Some allies, including Estonia, are now spending more than 3% or even 4%. We've been slow learners, but it's important that European governments are picking it up. Europe's defence spending trajectory has had a sharp upturn. It reached a total of €360 billion last year, a level not seen since the Cold War. But we all still have a long way to go, and we do not have the luxury of time. Russian imperialism is a threat to all of Europe, and it is important that our allies see it that way too. Now, on this theme, last week I was delighted to attend the NATO 75th anniversary commemoration conference hosted by the British Army Centre for Historical Analysis and Conflict Research. Speaking there were many senior figures, including a former Secretary General of NATO, a Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, the current Deputy Permanent Representative to NATO for Britain, and many experts, including Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman of King's College London, who I quoted on the podcast only last week. I also met several listeners to the podcast, including one chap from Denmark who listens every day on his commute. Skål. I think that's the right way of saying cheers. Many interesting things were said at the conference. There was much analysis of NATO shoring up its eastern flank, which was interesting. In the strategic sense, one expert emphasised that by most estimates, China will be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027, and that if Russia is in a position to do so, he believed that would be the most likely time that Moscow would use as an opportunity to strike somewhere else in Europe, particularly as America will be more focused on the Pacific theatre. Now, I put to one panel the problem of even the most optimistic US scenario from a NATO perspective, i.e. a second term for President Biden, and whether there was a widespread enough understanding within Europe and NATO that even in that scenario, there are severe limitations because the administration is unlikely to give enough to Kyiv strategically or militarily to enable it to win the war in a way defined by the Ukrainians. The response from Sir Lawrence was that, to Kaja Kallas' point in her interview with us, Europe has the economic weight and firepower to arm Kyiv to keep Moscow where it is in Ukraine, which may eventually make Moscow blink and ultimately withdraw. He said there is no reason why Europe cannot arm Ukraine even without the United States. Now, it's a fair point, but there are obvious challenges to that. One, as we've discussed extensively on the podcast and hope to do so again, is that there are question marks as to what weapons Europe can provide in the short term to Kyiv compared to what the US can give, which would be militarily decisive. And second, that the cost of a hold Russia and wait for them to blink strategy, as opposed to one seeking a more decisive, quicker end to the war, would come at a considerable cost in blood and everything else for Ukraine, and assumes that Russia will not become stronger over time, which remains a point, of course, of contention. Now, I'll come to another subject of conversation at the conference shortly, but just staying on this theme, which of course is pivotal, listeners may recall that Britain's former armed forces minister James Heapy resigned a few weeks ago, and he's given his first interview since leaving post to the House magazine of the UK Parliament, where he explains his reasons and concerns. Like Callis, he emphasises the cost of a Russian victory. To quote him, a stalemate or, heaven forbid, a Ukrainian defeat promises a new Cold War that will last for decades and cost trillions of dollars more. He went on that the latest aid packages that bring a quick and would not bring a complete quick and complete victory. He says, my expectation is that with this huge inflow of Western support, we'll see the front line stabilise, and that while the fighting will be fierce, we'll not see significant amounts of territory traded this year. Ukrainian brigades will need to be trained in a complemented manoeuvre that synchronises their movement with artillery fire, air support and everything else that can be thrown at the Russians. Thus, he says he doesn't believe that Ukrainian defenders will be likely to defeat the Russians until 2025 or even 2026. An interesting perspective there from a former military man himself, which is, I think, representative of a view quite common in Europe amongst the military fraternity at the moment, which is why I quote it here. And just lastly, for this segment, a few more updates on the continent. I mean, welcome news for Kyiv in that Polish protesters have at last unblocked all border crossing points with Ukraine, as a Ukrainian border guard spokesman has told Ukrainian television today. We don't know anything more about the details, but as we reported recently, the new Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk was keen to resolve this issue, as he said it was such a precarious moment for Kyiv in the war. Now, the other bit of interesting news is that Chinese President Xi Jinping will visit France, Serbia and Hungary in early May, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry has announced, with the war in Ukraine and the Middle East expected to be high on the agenda. We don't know any more about this either yet, though the countries chosen are interesting. France has been keen to retain a good relationship with Beijing among the Western powers, at least relative to them, though Serbia and Hungary are more sympathetic to the Kremlin, of course, as we've discussed many times. Privately, many senior Ukrainian officials will tell you that Beijing has been a problem for them, supporting Russia and defining an end to the war that was favourable to Moscow. So all eyes will be on this visit to see whether there are any tangible signs of any movements or indeed tensions between what she says with regard to the conflict in Ukraine and what we've seen so far.
Thank you very much, Francis. Just before we go to Hamish, then, I know you've got a few more updates from inside Russia. What have you been reading?
Yes, I'll try to be very brief. So the Financial Times has published a significant piece into Western companies still operating in Russia, which makes alarming reading, frankly. So they say the largest Western banks still operating in Russia paid more than 800 million euros in taxes to the Kremlin last year, in an illustration of how financial institutions are funding Putin's war in Ukraine. The seven top European banks by assets in Russia reported a combined profit of more than 3 billion in 2023, which was three times more than in 2021 before the war. Now, amongst those banks are UniCredit, ING, Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank and OTP. And the piece talks about how the profits were partly generated by funds that the banks were not able to withdraw from Russia. But nonetheless, the FT argues that this is still evidence of extensive, I suppose, production and financial benefiting from the Moscow market. Now, we'll add a link in the description, but it further underlines the extent to which many argue Western sanctions have not succeeded in cutting off the Kremlin's access to substantial Western funds. Now, just staying on Russia, two Russian journalists have been arrested on extremism charges and ordered to remain in custody pending investigation and trial on accusations of working for a group founded by the late opposition politician Alexei Navalny. So Konstantin Gubov and Sergei Karelin both deny the charges. They'll be detained for a minimum of 2 months before any trials begin, and each face a minimum of 2 years in prison and a maximum of 6 years for alleged participation in an extremist organisation. They're accused of preparing materials for a YouTube channel run by Navalny's Foundation for Fighting Corruption, which of course has been outlawed by Russian authorities. They are just the latest journalists arrested amid that Russian government crackdown on dissent and independent media that intensified after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, just since I referenced Navalny there, another interesting story on him. US intelligence agencies have reportedly determined that Russian authorities, Putin explicitly, probably didn't order the killing of opposition politician Navalny in February. They find that they are broadly in agreement. So this is the CIA, the Office of the Director of the National Intelligence, and the State Department's Intelligence Unit, say the Wall Street Journal, that he was not explicitly killed at that time. But nonetheless, that doesn't absolve Putin of overall responsibility for his death, given the opposition politician had been targeted for so many years, jailed on charges in terrible conditions, and of course was poisoned in 2020 with a nerve agent. Ultimately, he still died in Russian captivity, forced to endure terrible privations, and so many are suggesting that it matters little. But nonetheless, some evidence, there was a lot of speculation at the time that he may well have been explicitly killed prior to the election. It would seem that, according to American intelligence agencies, that the timing was not deliberate. But nonetheless, as I say, many are saying it doesn't really matter because the conditions he was being kept in was not good for his health, and it was only a matter of time before he succumbed. And just finally, since we're on this subject of Russia and I was at that conference last week, Putin was actually a subject of considerable discussion there because several of the attendees had personal dialogue with him in the early 2000s. Those who did, they emphasised his sense of humour in private and also how thin-skinned he can be. And indeed, one suggested that they believed that him being thin-skinned was the reason why the invasion was timed when it was, given some of the remarks by presidents about Russia and its increasing weakness. One stressed that it is a lie when propaganda from Russia says that Yeltsin was forced to sign things on Ukraine without really knowing what they meant. The fact is, these individuals were present when Putin himself signed documents that affirmed clearly and unequivocally that Ukraine was a sovereign nation in charge of its own future. Another very senior official at the conference also spoke to several important Russian military officials immediately before the war, including one who was on the Russian Security Council, and they'd spoken many, many times in the preceding years. That official, the one in the Russian Security Council, had said to this former NATO official that Russia would not invade Ukraine, that this was a deliberate flexing of muscles, and he was believed. And they think that that was because, actually, they themselves, the Russian officials, had been deceived by the Kremlin. So quite an interesting insight that. Now, it remains, they also said, an important part of the Russian military character, that when war comes, they rally around the leader, which is, of course, what we have broadly seen. They care much about the motherland and its protection, which also has ramifications for the Article 5 discussions, because they say they will not want to invoke Article 5 and threaten Russia itself, which means, of course, that they are likely to constrain Putin on doing anything that would likely invoke Article 5. So quite a few interesting perspectives from those, as I say, who actually knew Putin, saw him functioning up close, and have very high-ranking contacts, or had, at the very least, within Moscow. So hopefully a little bit of interesting colour on some of those eternal questions we've been asking ever since the war began. But conscious, I've been going on for long enough, David.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Francis Sternley, and before that, Dob Nichols, for your thoughts and reporting. Let's turn to our guest. Hamish, you've been looking at, I know, the issue of tanks. We reported last week that the US-supplied Abrams tanks had been taken out of frontline service by the Ukrainians, ostensibly because they were under too much threat from drones and Russian attacks, and they're going back to the rear to refine and think about their tactics. What was your reaction to this, and who have you been speaking to?
Yeah, well, hi, good afternoon, everybody. Great to be back at Telegraph Towers on a rare occasion up from the West Country. And some people might have seen my piece over the weekend about this, the Abrams tanks being withdrawn from the front line, ostensibly because they seem to be being harassed by these FP small $500 drones with explosives on them and taking out these $10 million tanks. I think there's quite a lot more to it than actually meets the eye here. I think, first of all, when we consider the Abrams and the Challenger 2 and the Leopard 2, these were tanks designed 20 or 30 years ago and not really configured for some of the threats that we're seeing on the battlefield at the moment. It was handheld anti-tank weapons originally that were giving the advantage against tanks, then mines, and this year the FP drones. So it's not that unsurprising. And it is common knowledge, I think, that some of the super tech stuff off Abrams in particular has been removed because of the fear that some of that tech would fall into Russian hands. However, having said that, let's look at the actual situation itself before one suggests how they can get around this. First of all, the tanks have been used very much in a static way so far on the front line. And as you can imagine, a big sort of 70-ton beast is quite easily picked up, even well camouflaged. And if it doesn't move, then it is very susceptible. It's true that particularly the Challenger 2 has been very effective with its 120mm rifled gun firing accurately up to 3,500 metres and having an impact. However, the key elements to a tank and tank warfare, we break down into what we call firepower, the punch it can hit, protection, how it can take a lot of incoming, and mobility. Now, singularly, those are impressive capabilities, but actually the tank works best when they're all put together. Firepower, protection and mobility, and part of what we call combined arms warfare. That means tanks working with artillery, working with infantry and working with air power, moving rapidly to be able to punch a hole and break through. So one would hope that is what is now being considered by the Ukraine forces, who I know hitherto have been struggling to use that sort of armoured punch. And the other thing about the person who invented, if you like, General Heinz Guderian, German general in the Second World War, invented Blitzkrieg, and that was all about fast, rapid movement. If you can imagine a tank moving at 50 miles an hour, is a lot more difficult to hit for an FP drone of one that's static. But when one looks at how we overcome them, many people have seen the bar armor, the sort of steel bars on top of tanks, which not only intercept anti-tank guided weapons, can also intercept drones. There is explosive reactive armor that can be used. And I think there's a lot of talk about electronic countermeasures or jammers, if you like, which are a lot of these drones are using off-the-shelf technology, which can be interdicted. And I want to talk about the Russian turtle tanks in a minute, but before I do, I think there is hope for optimism, even with this potentially or seemingly bad news of Abrams tanks being withdrawn. Actually, that combined arms mover that we've talked about many times, we now know that the advanced, most modern ATACMS, long-range, precision-guided missiles, 300 kilometres plus, are now in the theatre of operations and having a severe impact on the Russian logistic lines. And I think Don might be talking about that a bit more tomorrow or even later today. We also know the F-16s are coming over the horizon. Now, how many they're going to be and when they're going to be, it seems to be fairly imminent. That's the air power element of it, got the artillery element. We know we've got the infantry element. And if they can corral and train those tanks, that there is hope for that. But moving on to the turtle tanks, and again, the paper has covered this, and I'm sure lots of people have seen them. These are basically a T-72 that's covered in a sort of steel, you know, almost looks like my tin shed. And they look rather comical, but actually, they're being pretty effective. The Russians are using them with a mine plow on the front to guide the infantry onto positions. And although their main armament cannot fire in much of an arc, just forward looking, it's having an impact. And of course, they've still got a couple of heavy machine guns. And these turtle tanks appear to have some pretty good jammers, electronic warfare, to be able to interdict the mines. And the shed seems to be their way to stop the Ukrainian FPV drones from taking them out. And this sort of adaptation on the battlefield, because things change so quickly on the battlefield, technically, and you've got to try and stay one step ahead of the enemy. Some of you may have heard from the Second World War something called Hobart's Funnies. General Hobart, basically with 79 Armored Division and the engineers within it, created these sort of various changes to tanks, mainly Churchill's and Sherman's, to allow them to overcome obstacles. They, similar to the Turtle, they had a Sherman with a mine roller on the front of it. They had flails as well to do minefields. They had flamethrowers. They had the ability to chuck great fascines into sort of trenches. And they also had one that swam across rivers. So the Russian Turtle, to me, is very much the sort of the Hobart's Funnies of Ukraine. And it might look smart or pretty or whatever, but it's about being effective. And those Turtle tanks seem to be effective. And no doubt, hopefully, the Ukrainians will be following suit. So I think really timely and teeing up in my final thoughts, perhaps Dom and I's chat at the Chalk History Festival coming up at the end of June on this subject and others to do with tanks. I think it's good to try and put it into perspective.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Hamish. We'll come back to you shortly because I know you've got another update for us. But Dom, would you like to come in and just add your thoughts there, also as a former tank commander?
Yeah, thanks, David. I just want to add to what Hamish was saying there about the tank. The experience of the last couple of years in Ukraine, there have been many articles, maybe I've written a couple, I don't know, about does this herald the end of the tank? We just need to be a bit careful about that, but we should also be cognizant of what is going on at the moment. And I've said before that a tank wouldn't be able to move if it was absolutely so covered in armour that it was protected from all angles. Most of the armour is at the front of the tank and on the turret, the bit that's traditionally pointing towards the enemy. And of course, in the modern battlefield, there isn't really, doesn't really work like that. So we've seen tanks be very vulnerable since the start of the full-scale invasion. But if you remember, 2022, we're all saying that the handheld anti-tank missiles like the NLAW and the Javelin, they could kill all the tanks. Then in 2023, with the Ukraine's failed offensive, it was mines. Mines were going to kill all the tanks. Now in 2024, it's first-person view. Drones, they're going to kill all the tanks. So, I mean, they can't all be right, but I think it's a little bit of all of it. You know, tanks have always had vulnerabilities. As I said, you can't cover it in armor. Well, you can do cover it in armor, but it's not going to move, so it's not a tank. It's a pillbox. So tanks have generally, to all these things, mines, handheld anti-tank, all the rest of it, they've generally come up with an answer, if not the tank themselves and the wider system around them, have come up with answers to each of these problems. And they will find answers to first-person view drones. That might include accepting a higher degree of risk, a higher casualty rate amongst the tanks. You know, you expect to lose more in any given scenario. But there will be an answer. But for me now, right now, there are four things that we need to consider about the vulnerability or the threat to tanks right now as exposed in the war in Ukraine. Firstly, the speed with which first-person view drones have hit the battlefield mean that they are, that issue is light years ahead of where the armoured fraternity are in trying to come up with a solution. So they've just got a long way to catch up. Secondly, the layers of anti-tank capabilities, first-person view drones, mines, anti-tank missiles held by infantry squads that can run around and get up the back, for example. But the layers of anti-tank capabilities means that armour is being overloaded in terms of the countermeasures that it has to employ. So if you've got some snazzy technical answers to all these things, again, if you need all of them, the thing might not be able to move because it's just too covered in heavy kit. Thirdly, the relative, and I stress relative, the relative low cost of the different layers in that system means that they can be procured in bulk compared to the millions you spend on the tanks. And finally, the relatively low training burden combined with that low cost means that all the different elements of these things that can kill tanks can be held widely across lots of different parts of the military, not just in specialized units. So right now, all those things together, I think, have tipped the scales in terms of a tank is more vulnerable than it is capable of delivering its traditional shock and awe on the battlefield. And hence, we've seen so many get knocked out, but also this decision to withdraw Abrams and probably Leopards and Challengers as well. It comes back to a point I made some weeks ago when we talk about air power and about how tanks are vulnerable, everything's vulnerable, and it helps if you've got air supremacy, i.e. you own the sky, or local air superiority, as in you own a chunk of the sky for a small piece of time under which you can do largely whatever you want. And that area there, close air support, the the aircraft, the jets that are able to provide that close air support such that the tanks are not too vulnerable underneath them. That has been really challenged in Ukraine right now because of the prevalence of manned portable air defence and the air defence system, and also the age of drone warfare. And I was asking folks some weeks ago to throw me their ideas on where do first-person view drones leave this idea of close air support, because I wonder that even if the enemy had local air superiority, so their piloted aircraft can roam freely, I think piloted aircraft still are going to have a hard job taking out these individual drones. So even if the enemy's got air superiority, you might be able to achieve, a clunky phrase I've just come up with, micro air superiority. If you could swarm FPV drones for a small piece of time and space such that you might be able to protect your tanks. So, or conversely, knock any out that are coming towards you if you have air superiority. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment on the battlefield. Tanks are the most obvious area where all these things are coming to a head and being proved vulnerable. But I think there's a lot more to it. It's too early to say that the era of the tank is over, but we should be cognizant that it's not just a question of, oh, these things are big and heavy, therefore they are vulnerable. Well, they've always been vulnerable, but I think there are those four components combined with what's happening in the sky that mean that that we see the results that we do at the moment. But any thoughts on all of that, especially the newly coined Nichols trademark, micro air superiority, most welcome.
Well, thank you, Dom. Hamish, back to you, away from tanks. I know you've got one more update for us before we go to our final thoughts.
Yeah, thanks very much, David. And yeah, interesting stuff there, Dom. I'm sure Edward Stringer, our friendly air power super, will comment, and I'm having a chat with him later in the week, so I'll get his views on that. But yeah, just a very quick one on another piece that I was writing last week about the extensive use of CS gas on the front lines. And I think we're hearing over the weekend the concerns of the senior generals of Ukraine that there is significant pressure on those front lines. And I have been surprised, following up with Jimmy Rushton's piece, I've been speaking to him, also people like Paul Conroy, the well-known photographer who's been out in Ukraine since the very start, on, you know, quite how prevalent this is. And apparently it is incredibly prevalent, the use of this stuff. But what is frustrating is a very easy to counter. The guys on the front line just need some decent gas masks or respirators, the technical term. And those who read my piece will have seen that Ben Wallace, previous defence secretary, has waded in on this to see if we can get some stuff for them. And also Bob Seeley, who is the MP who is head of the Ukraine all-party group, has also waded in. So we shall see, and we'll keep an eye on how that develops.
Well, thank you so much, Hamish, and it's really great to see you in London. Any other updates? Dom, I think you might have one before we head to our final thoughts.
Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, is in Kyiv today, his third visit to Ukraine, or to the capital, since the start of the full-scale invasion. He has said that the alliance, NATO alliance, has failed to live up to the promises of aid that it has made over the last couple of years. He's due to address Ukraine's parliament, the Rada, later on today, I think. And he said in advance of that, he said, I will also be very honest with President Zelensky and also with the Rada that NATO allies have not delivered what we have promised over the last months. The United States spent 6 months to agree a package, and European allies have not delivered the ammunition we promised. But now I'm confident that things will change, he's reported as saying in Kyiv. I mean, interesting. It's a bit of a, you know, hands up moment. It doesn't, he said similar in the past, but not wrapped it all up together, you know, in Kyiv with the yellow pages down the back of his trousers because he knows he's going to get a spanking. But within the context of the idea of the next presidential election in the US and this idea we've heard from various people of Trump proofing the Western assistance to Ukraine, if Donald Trump was elected again, and as is thought likely, he is much cooler on the support for Ukraine than Biden, then, you know, Europe needs to do more, the rest of the world needs to do more. And I think Jens Stoltenberg is signalling there that more is expected. And I think, for example, last week we were talking about the provision of Patriot air systems, where there are thought to be 100 systems across Europe, and, you know, having trouble stumping extra ones up for Ukraine. Germany provided a third. Spain said they'd supply missiles, but not the actual launchers. So in the context of that, I think it's interesting Jens Stoltenberg is going public and saying that the alliance has dropped the ball a little bit. Now, if anything comes out of it, we wait and see. But I think finally, they're saying that the right people are saying the right things. But now we just need to see the results from it.
Well, thank you, Dom. Just as a reminder to our listeners of how fluid and dynamic the situation on the front lines are, while we've been on air, Russia's defence ministry has claimed it's captured the village of Semenivka in Donetsk, fairly close to Avdiivka. This is a little bit south of Otcheratne. And they've also announced the capture yesterday of Novobakhmutivka. So all of this stuff we're getting, of course, we will try and verify that. But there's certainly movement on the front lines. Francis Sternley, can I come to you for your final thought, please?
Well, thanks, David. A little bit of a different one from me in which to conclude. But there have been rumours in the Western press about the illness and possible imminent death of Russian ally, I don't know how you best describe him, really, hereditary vassal dictator of Chechnya, Kadyrov. And he's often described as Putin's loyalist henchman. And indeed, I remember we used to speak about him a lot, particularly memorable propaganda films coming out from him and all sort of bombastic claims about what the men that he'd sent to Ukraine were up to there. But what's interesting on this is the instability of Chechnya and the implications of his death, or at least his being very unwell, and what that might mean for the Ukraine context. So Mark Galeotti, who I know you interviewed for the podcast recently, a very interesting episode, which we'll add a link to in the description, he said, and in a piece for The Times, that this is extremely important, actually, and that it's being underreported. So he says that Putin will want to arrange a smooth succession. Kadyrov, who succeeded his father, hoped to build a dynasty, elevating his oldest son. However, he is just 18. So there are other candidates that may well be better placed, leading to a sort of power struggle within this sort of semi-autonomous region within Russia. Indeed, one of the front runners is a commander of mercenary units in Ukraine. He might want to, as we often argue about what Russia might be obliged to do if there was a power struggle within Russia, withdraw troops from Ukraine, bring them back in order to fight in some sort of power struggle. So stability in Chechnya, he says, was brought after the war through massive federal subsidies and a balance of terror between rival armed camps, all of whom pledged loyalty to Kadyrov but mistrust each other. With him gone, all of that semi-stability will erode and could well have ramifications for the military context and indeed Russia's own security. It will pose what he describes as a terrible dilemma for Putin, for whom it comes at the worst possible moment. Galeotti ends by saying pacifying Chechnya and preventing instability in this region from spreading to the rest of the volatile North Caucasus would almost certainly require a substantial deployment of Russian forces. So a really interesting piece, and one that I think we will be finding ourselves commenting on again over the coming weeks.
Thank you very much, Francis. Dom Nichols, would you like to go next?
Yeah, thanks, David. A couple of things have stuck out to me over the weekend that add a bit more food for thought in the whole escalation provocation debate. Now, you might have seen there were two logistic trains destroyed deep inside Russia. This is Ukraine's military intelligence agency said that they reported it, which I guess is the same thing as saying they did it, because I didn't hear about it from anywhere else. They said one train was destroyed in Orenburg. That's about 1,000 kilometres east of Ukraine. The HUR say it was destroyed by unknown persons yesterday. Although, like I say, if they're telling us, then make your own mind up. And another logistic train, overnight Friday, Saturday, was destroyed by fire in the Russian city of Vladikavkaz. These are hundreds and thousands of miles away from Ukraine. So I don't think these are a TACM that we were talking about last week. But it comes obviously last Thursday we saw that, or was it Friday actually? It was while we were on air, Friday. That helicopter, Russian helicopter, destroyed at a military airfield about 20k south of Moscow, which looked like it was people on the ground that actually did it. So you know, these strikes deep, deep, deep inside Russia. Hold that thought for one moment. Now, US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, alongside General Charles Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they gave a press conference on Friday when Lloyd Austin, was asked about the provision of the long-range version of ATACMS that has been sent and we think used in Ukraine. Now, he stressed ATACMS is not a silver bullet, but when specifically asked whether their potential use inside Russia had been a factor in the decision to send them, he said, direct, and I'm going to read the whole quote just so you've got the full-ish. He said, "As you know, I always have a concern about the US having the capability to defend itself and also support our operational plans. And I can tell you that we're comfortable, that we're in a good place, and will remain in a good place. In 2 years' time, things change. We're in a good place. We'll remain in a good place, and I think the capability that Ukraine will have is a good capability. He then couldn't hide a big smirk breaking out on his face. So in that answer, he didn't shut it down, and he started talking about US ability to defend itself, did not say anything about hinting at whether it was good or bad that they were, you know, operating inside Russia. But he then composed himself and carried on. He said, it's up to them, as in Ukraine, it's up to them on how and when to use it. And our hopes are that they'll create some pretty good effects with that and other things. He smiled again, but then did better the second time to hide it. General Brown then chipped in and said, I can't predict a timeline of where the Ukrainians will have the opportunity, but we can change the future. That's exactly what this supplemental has been able to do, to help shape the future. So I thought, that's the end of the quote. I thought all that was very interesting, that they, you know, neither of them shut it down. Neither of them gave a very bland answer, I think, about the use of ATACMS inside Russia. And General Brown in particular, interesting, you know, he's the serving military guy, not the politician, but I thought he went a bit further talking about changing the future. And so in the context of escalation, plus all the smirking, I thought that they were very interesting comments, different, very different from the recent thoughts about the US being unhappy with Ukrainian forces targeting, you know, Russian oil facilities and other deep strikes inside Russia. And I just wonder if the dial is shifting on this, on how provocative and escalatory it would be to strike inside Russia. And if that thought is shifting, it comes as Ukraine is getting some very, very deep strike, precise potential munitions to do so. So I thought it was an interesting addition last Friday, David.
Thank you very much, Dom and Francis. Hamish, can I come to you for your final thoughts?
Yeah, thanks very much. And I would just, my final thought really is to give a plug to the world's leading history festival, the Chalk History Festival, that happens at the end of the June, which this year, for the first time, will include the Daily Telegraph's Ukraine, the latest pod team. I think there are two turns happening, one on Ukraine and one on tanks. But this festival, which is selling out fast, run by James Holland, his brother Tom will also be there, as will James May, Al Murray, Frank Gardner, Willie Dalrymple and Michael Palin, to mention a few. So I think we'll hopefully put the website details on the notes to this pod. But apart from hearing the elite Telegraph team covering, you know, the thoughts of the day, there are a tremendous amount of other things to see there and people to see there. And I think everybody will be there all day on the 27th, and it'd be great for people to come and have a chat. Certainly as the sort of the outpost of the pod in the West Country, I know how many people rely on the pod for everything to do with Ukraine, and I'm sure there will be a lot of people there. So, yeah, Chalk History Festival, 27th of June. See you then.
Thank you, Dom, Francis and Hamish.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The Ukrainian Security and Cooperation Center was established as an independent source of information and analysis on Ukraine for audiences abroad and at home.
A few weeks ago, Francis spoke to Serhii Kuzan, its head, about information gathered by the centre on resistance in the occupied territories, the causes of Russian war crimes, and the process of recording incidents of atrocities. Here is their conversation.
Our mission is talking about the war in general, so the people will not forget about that there's still a war. This is one mission, and another mission is we are working on the reforms and the new commanders for our army, so we can change something.
Can you talk a little bit about the work you do for the Ukrainian army?
This is in case of occupation. We didn't know what the scale of occupation that it would be. So then in the summer 2021, we worked on the law for the territorial defense to found this type of forces, resistance units.
Resistance movement.
Yes.
Found the preparation and trainings on those units and those forces. And also on the civilian preparation to the war, how they can act in case if they're not in the military, but as a civilians, how they should react in case of war.
Яка може бути окупація? Вона могла бути на значно більшій території України.
And are some of those people that you trained now in the occupied territories in the east?
Так.
Yes.
Так. І там є дійсно осередки.
Both sides, there is some resistance movements. On the east, unfortunately, it is less powerful than the south, because the east is occupied much more longer than the south. But in Crimea also, there is quite powerful movement of resistance, and it works. And these movements, they are also coordinated by our special operation forces.
We as journalists, we try and understand what is going on in the occupied territories, but information is obviously limited. Is there more happening in the occupied territories than perhaps we know about in terms of the resistance? And are those operations successful?
Я скажу так, якщо поміряти, то 90%, ну, я можу...
If I cannot measure what everybody see, probably 80% of operations are not showed in media. Mostly we see some of the results of the operation, but we cannot see the communication, how it happens, the process of organization and communication, and also especially the sabotage of the Russians on the occupied territories. Also the Russian security forces from the last year, they start to control everything much more. Also the special operation forces and the general reconnaissance service, they organize a very well network on the occupied territories and also on the territories near the border, like in Belgorod. And we can see how it's effective and how they help us when the Russian volunteer corpus, RDK, and the Legion of Freedom of Russia, when they came to Belgorod, we can see how it's effective.
If you are a Russian soldier in the occupied territories, is it something that is quite anxiety-inducing, knowing that these operations are taking place?
Absolutely. And we, наші спецслужби отримували...
In the early first months of the full-scale invasion, for them it was a big shock. The Russians who came to occupy some territories, because they expect that people will welcome them with
yes.
flowers and all that, and bread and salt. But for them it was a shock that people did some resistance, and as they know from the American units, they catch some radio walkie-talks that the Russians was shocked that it's not happened. And they start to control everything much, much more. They've been scared to move, so they have a specific route they can move in the areas, and they cannot even choose another way. So, yeah.
Поліська і Херсонська область, це стало абсолютним шоком.
Staying on the Russian occupied forces and also Russia generally, I know that the organization focuses a lot on Russia itself, the health of Russian society. What is your assessment of the state of Russian society? Is it getting worse from a Ukrainian perspective? Are there signs for optimism? Interested to hear your perspective.
For me, it was a shock that they can be so inhuman and how they can do everything. On the beginning of the full-scale invasion, we got the database of the phone numbers of the families the soldiers who was here and the competitors and who did those war crimes as raping, killing children, women and just as civilians. And we get in touch with their families, with the wives, mothers, etc. And we share with them information that your son or your husband raped the children, the women, etc. And it was a shock that we got. So the feedback was most of the people, it was okay with them. They told that it is like it should be. The Ukrainian women are wars and a lot of bad words to the civilians. So this is weird. They can have a thoughts like just from civilians to civilians like that. But at the beginning of this invasion, we thought that the Belarus also can attack Ukraine from their side, but we didn't found that the Belarusian society, they react same as Russians, because they speak also Russian. They have similar culture to Russia, but at the same time, the civilians and society, they didn't react same as Russians.
As an expert, how do you explain that behavior in Russia? Because as you say, this is not something that developed over the course of the war. This was from day one. How do you explain that?
Так, абсолютно, тому що ми досліджували Росію, ну, власне кажучи,
been analyzing Russia since 2014, and I've seen at that moment in 2014 in some proactive political and civilian organizations, they already had that state of mind, but since 2014 it was just growing up deeper into society. I cannot emulate Putin that this is only his kind of problem that he made the society like that. I think that now the top of the politics in Russia, they are just mirroring what the society thinks. So this is the both sides.
Yes, that's interesting. How would you assess the global awareness of war crimes? Reporting on this war now for 2 years, we report a lot on the issue of war crimes, kidnapped children, for instance, but also Bucha, Irpin. It seems that people are very interested and focused on the military side, the political, but the war crimes has not penetrated people's minds generally. How would you assess where we are in understanding the war crimes, and how can we perhaps better make people understand what is going on?
Сміливість і політичне рішення, більше нічого.
So the problem is probably in the Western understanding of the weakness in general, and what need to do is the honor, the bravery, and the political actions. Because, for example, the situation with MH17 in 2015, it was obvious that not any some small military resistance groups can hit such a big situation happen. So it was quite clear that this is was with the Russian support, and just a year ago they got the answer that it was the war crime. So it takes 10 years, for example. What we can talk about the crimes would happen now, it is obvious. We can go to European, to Bucha, to talk with the people, and there is a lot of evidence what's happened, but if we'll have the answer just in the 10 years, what we can talk about. So the main thing is, it's what needs to the Western understanding is just a bravery to accept and realize that, and the political actions. Also, one of the problems that the West is trying to include the Russian opinion about what's happened in Bucha.
Yeah.
And this is totally crooked.
Боягузтво перед Росією. Все, більше немає.
The center has obviously been working on the documenting of war crimes in Kyiv, Kharkiv, Kherson. Those are very large places, and we know how many crimes there have been committed. How do you go about documenting all that material? What is your process, and how much of what has happened are you able to record? You know, do you only capture 5%, 10%? So I'm interested in your process and how much you capture.
Абсолютно невеликий відсоток. Тобто всього
if you want to take all the prosecutors from all the Ukraine with all this big team, maybe then I can take like all the war crimes what's happened on the territories. Obviously there was and still probably exists a lot of organizations, not non like NGOs, organizations who was also documenting the war crimes. Yes. Now it's mostly the prosecutors and the government organizations, but our organization is just one of them. The main thing that most of the war crimes are not under investigation still. So there was a fact, but nobody investigated. And also, after European Bucha, there was a lot of war crimes, much more worse than European Bucha. But after that, Russians start to hide all the results of it, and there is no possibility to investigate it.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.